Lazar that when I get back to Belgrade we shall give the answer. Lazar told me from what he had heard that it was to be no ordinary note, but I stood firmly by my reply. Sure enough, he and Sayinovich went to take their seats in the train to Thessaloniki. Only when the train reached Leskovats, nearly 50 kilometers south of Nish, was the Prime Minister persuaded to return by a telegram from Prince Regent Alexander. This was bizarre but not uncharacteristic behavior. We may recall that in the summer of 1903, when the details of the planned assassination of King Alexander and Queen Draga were passed to him in advance by the regicides, Pashich had reacted by taking his family by train to the Adriatic coast, then under Austrian rule, where he could wait out the consequences. What exactly he had in mind on the afternoon on the 23rd of July is impossible to establish. He may simply, as Albertini suggested, have hoped to avoid the weighty responsibilities of accepting the note. Interestingly enough, Berchtold had learned through unspecified secret channels that Pashich intended to resign immediately on receiving it. He may just have panicked, or perhaps he felt the need to clear his head and think over his options. The exigencies of a national election, coupled with the greatest external crisis in the history of the modern Serbian state, had doubtless placed him under considerable strain. Whatever it was, the moment passed, and the Prime Minister and the political director arrived in Belgrade at 5 a.m. on the 24th of July. It took a little time for a Serbian response to the ultimatum to crystallize. On the evening of the 23rd of July, while Pašić was traveling back to the capital, Paču dispatched a circular note to the Serbian legations stating that the demands set out in the Austrian note were such as no Serbian government could accept them in their entirety. Paču reaffirmed this view when he paid a visit to Chargé d'Affaires Strandman, who, following the death of Hartwig, was acting chief of the Russian mission. After Paču had left, Prince Alexander appeared to discuss the crisis with Strandman. He too insisted that acceptance of the ultimatum was an absolute impossibility for a state which has the slightest regard for its dignity, and added that he placed his trust in the magnanimity of the Tsar of Russia, whose powerful word alone could save Serbia. Early on the next morning it was Pašić's turn to see Strandman. The Prime Minister took the view that Serbia should neither accept nor reject the Austrian note, and must immediately seek a postponement of the deadline. An appeal would be made to the powers to protect the independence of Serbia. But, Pašić added, if war is unavoidable, we shall fight. All of this might seem to suggest that the Serbian political leadership came almost immediately to the unanimous view that Serbia must resist, and, if necessary, go to war. But these utterances were all reported by Strandman. It is likely that the desire to elicit Russian support encouraged the ministers on hand in Belgrade to insist on the impossibility of acceptance. Other testimony suggests that, among themselves, the decision-makers were deeply alarmed at the prospect of an Austrian attack and saw no alternative to acceptance. The memory of October 1913, when Sazonov had advised Belgrade to back down in the face of an Austrian ultimatum over Albania, was still fresh enough to nourish doubts about whether the Russians would support Serbia in the current crisis. Ascertaining the attitude of France was difficult, because the key French leaders were on their way back from Russia and the French envoy Decaux, who for some time had been showing signs of strain, had collapsed and been recalled to Paris. His replacement had not yet arrived. No decision was reached at the first cabinet meeting convened by Paču on the evening of the 23rd of July, and the situation remained unresolved after Pašić's return on the following morning. Pašić merely determined that no decision should be taken until the Russians had made their view known. In addition to the conversations with Strandman, which were, of course, reported immediately to St. Petersburg, there were two official requests for clarification. Pašić cabled Spalajković, asking him to ascertain the views of the Russian government. On the same day, Prince Regent Alexander sent a telegram to the Tsar stating that Serbia could not defend itself, and that the Belgrade government was preparing to accept any points of the ultimatum, whose acceptance shall be advised by Your Majesty, the Russian Tsar. The Italian historian Luciano Magrini concluded from his interviews with key Serbian decision-makers and other witnesses to the events of those days that the Belgrade government had, in effect, decided to accept the ultimatum and avoid war. It was thought that in the condition she was known to be in, Serbia could not be expected to do otherwise than yield to so terrible a threat. It was evidently in a mood of resignation that Pašić composed his telegram of the 25th of July to the Serbian missions, declaring that Belgrade intended to send a reply that would be conciliatory on all points and offer Vienna full satisfaction. This was unmistakably a major step back from Pašić's much firmer circular of 2 days before. A telegram from Krakenthorpe to Gray, dispatched just after midday on the 25th of July, confirms that at this point the Serbs were even willing to accept the notorious points 5 and 6, calling for a mixed commission of inquiry, provided that the appointment of such commission can be proved to be in accordance with international usage. It may have been reassurances from the Russians that stiffened the backs of the Serbs. At around 8:30 a.m. on the 23rd of July, a telegram dispatched on the evening of the previous day arrived from Spalajković, reporting his conversation with Poincaré during the state visit. The French president had asked the Serbian envoy if there was news from Belgrade. When Spalajković replied that the situation was very bad, Poincaré had said, "We will help you to improve it." This was gratifying, but not especially substantial. At around midnight on the 24th of July, a telegram reached Belgrade announcing that a bold decision was imminent. The most important of Spalajković's dispatches were two telegrams sent on the night of the 24th to the 25th of July, detailing a conversation with Sazonov sometime before 7 p.m. on the 24th of July, in which the Russian foreign minister had conveyed to the Serbian envoy the results of a meeting of the Council of Ministers held at 3 o'clock that afternoon. In the first telegram, Spalajković reported that the Russian foreign minister had condemned the Austro-Hungarian ultimatum with disgust, declaring that no state could accept such demands without committing suicide. Sazonov had assured Spalajković that Serbia could count unofficially on Russian support, but he did not specify which form this help would take, because there were matters for the Tsar to decide and consult on with France. In the meanwhile, Serbia should avoid any unnecessary provocations. If the country were attacked and unable to defend itself, it should, in the first instance, withdraw its armed forces southeastwards into the interior. The aim was not to accept an Austrian occupation, but rather to keep Serbia's armies in readiness for a subsequent deployment. The second telegram of that night, dispatched at 1:40 a.m. on the 25th of July, reported that the Russian Ministerial Council had decided to take energetic measures, even mobilization, and were about to publish an official communique in which Russia takes Serbia under its protection. At 8 p.m. on the 25th of July, Spalajković fired off a further dispatch, reporting that he had spoken with the Serbian military attaché, who had just returned from the Tsar's residence at Carskaya Sela. The attaché had been talking with the chief of the Russian General Staff, and told Spalajković that the military council had shown the greatest readiness for war, and was resolved to go to any length in protecting Serbia. The Tsar in particular had surprised everybody with his determination. Moreover, it had been ordered that at exactly 6 p.m., the deadline for the Serbian reply, all the final-year cadets in Russia were to be raised to officer rank, a clear signal of imminent full mobilization. In all circles, without exception, the greatest resolve and jubilation reigns on account of the stance adopted by the Tsar and his government. Other dispatches reported on the military measures that were already being taken, the mood of pride and readiness for any sacrifice that pervaded the ruling circles and the public sphere, and the excitement that greeted the news from London that the British fleet had been ordered to a state of readiness. It was probably the news from Russia that dispelled the mood of fatalism in Belgrade and dissuaded the ministers from attempting to avoid war by acquiescing in the demands of the ultimatum. Spolykovich's telegram of the 24th of July, conveying Sazonov's vague assurance of support, arrived in Belgrade in two parts, the first at 4:17 a.m. and the second at 10 a.m. on the 25th of July. The telegram hinting at Russian mobilization arrived at 11:30 a.m. on the same day, in good time to reach the Serbian ministers before they had drafted their reply to the Austrian note. Notwithstanding this firming of the mood, the Serbian ministers invested immense effort in polishing their reply to Vienna in order to create the appearance of offering the maximum possible compliance without compromising Serbian sovereignty. Pašić, Ljuba Jovanović, and most of the ministers then present in Belgrade, including those of the Interior, Economics and Justice, Stojan Protić, Velizar Janković, and Marko Đuričić, all had a hand in the numerous redactions of the text. Slavko Grujić, Secretary-General of the Serbian Foreign Ministry, later described to Luigi Albertini the hectic activity that preceded the presentation of the reply. During the afternoon of Saturday the 25th of July, there were numerous drafts as the ministers took turn in adding and scratching out various passages. Even the final version was so covered in alterations, insertions, and crossings out that it was virtually illegible. At last, after 4 p.m., the text seemed finally settled, and an attempt was made to type it out. But the typist was inexperienced and very nervous, and the typewriter refused to work, with the result that the reply had to be written out by hand in hectographic ink, copies being jellied off. The last half hour was one of feverish work. The reply was corrected by pen here and there. One whole phrase, placed in parenthesis, was crossed out in ink and made illegible. At 5:45, Grujić handed the text to Pašić in an envelope. Pašić had hoped that Grujić or some other subordinate figure would convey the reply to Baron Giesel, but when no one volunteered, he said, "Very well, I will take it myself," descended the stairs and walked to the meeting with Giesel, while the ministers and officials all rushed to make the train to Niš, to which the Serbian government was relocating in preparation for the coming conflict. The Serbian reply may have looked messy, but it was a masterpiece of diplomatic equivocation. Baron Musilin, who had composed the first draft of the Austrian ultimatum, described it as the most brilliant specimen of diplomatic skill that he had ever encountered. The reply opened with a confident flourish. The Serbian government, it was asserted, had demonstrated on many occasions during the Balkan Wars its moderate and peaceful attitude. Indeed, it was thanks to Serbia and to the sacrifice that she has made in the exclusive interest of European peace that that peace had been preserved. The drafters of the reply were therefore confident that their response would remove any misunderstandings between the two countries. Since the government could not be held responsible for the actions of private individuals and exercised no direct controls over the press or the peaceable work of societies, it had been surprised and pained by the accusations emanating from Vienna. In their replies to the individual points, the drafters offered a subtle cocktail of acceptances, conditional acceptances, evasions, and rejections. They agreed officially to condemn all propaganda aimed at the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the annexation of its territories, though they used a modal form of the verb that avoided the implication that there had ever actually been any such propaganda. On the question of the suppression of irredentist organizations, the reply stated that the Serbian government possessed no proof that the Narodna Odbrana or other similar societies had as yet committed any criminal act. Nevertheless, they agreed to dissolve the Narodna Odbrana and any other society that may be directing its efforts against Austria-Hungary. Point 3 stated that the government would happily remove from Serbian public education any anti-Austrian propaganda whenever the imperial and royal government furnished them with facts and proofs of this propaganda. Point 4 agreed to the removal from the military of suspect persons, but again, only once the Austro-Hungarian authorities had communicated to them the names and acts of these officers and functionaries. On the question of the creation of mixed Austro-Serbian commissions of inquiry, point 5, the reply stated that the Serbian government did not clearly grasp the meaning or scope of the demand, but that they undertook to accept such collaboration, inasmuch as it could be shown to agree with the principle of international law, with criminal procedure, and with good neighbourly relations. Point 6, on the participation of Austrian officials in the prosecution of implicated persons, was rejected outright on the grounds that this would be contrary to the Serbian constitution. This was the issue touching on Serbia's sovereignty, on which Sazonov had urged Belgrade to stand firm. As for point 7, calling for the arrest of Tankosic and Siganovic, the Serbian government stated that it had already arrested Tankosic on the very evening of the delivery of the note. It had not yet been possible to arrest Siganovic. Again, the Austrian government were asked to provide the presumptive evidence of guilt, as well as the proofs of guilt, if there are any, for the purposes of the later inquiry. This was a somewhat devious response. As soon as the name of Siganovic had cropped up in connection with the Sarajevo inquiry, the prefecture of police in Belgrade had hustled him out of the capital on a special commission, all the while officially denying that any person by the name of Milan Siganovic existed in the city. The reply accepted without condition points 8 and 10 regarding the prosecution of frontier officials found guilty of illegal activity, and the duty to report to the Austro-Hungarian government on the measures undertaken. But point 9, under which the Austrians had demanded an explanation of hostile public comments by Serbian officials during the days following the assassinations, elicited a more equivocal response. The Serbian government would gladly give such explanations once the Austrian government had communicated to them the passages in question in these remarks, and as soon as they have shown that the remarks were actually made by said officials. It is hard to dissent from Mussolini's breathless admiration for this finely wrought text. The claim often made in general narratives that this reply represented an almost complete capitulation to the Austrian demands is profoundly misleading. This was a document fashioned for Serbia's friends, not for its enemy. It offered the Austrians amazingly little. Above all, it placed the onus on Vienna to drive ahead the process of opening up the investigation into the Serbian background of the conspiracy, without, on the other hand, conceding the kind of collaboration that would have enabled an effective pursuit of the relevant leads. In this sense, it represented a continuation of the policy the Serbian authorities had followed since the 28th of June, flatly to deny any form of involvement and to abstain from any initiative that might be taken to indicate the acknowledgement of such involvement. Many of the replies on specific points opened up the prospect of long, querulous, and in all likelihood, ultimately pointless negotiations with the Austrians over what exactly constituted facts and proofs of irredentist propaganda or conspiratorial activity by officers and officials. The appeal to international law, though effective as propaganda, was pure obfuscation, since there existed no international jurisprudence for cases of this kind, and no international organs with the authority to resolve them in a legal and binding way. Yet the text was perfectly pitched to convey the tone of voice of reasonable statesmen in a condition of sincere puzzlement, struggling to make sense of outrageous and unacceptable demands. This was the measured voice of the political, constitutional Serbia, disavowing any ties with its expansionist pan-Serbian twin in a manner deeply rooted in the history of Serbian external relations. It naturally sufficed to persuade Serbia's friends that in the face of such a full capitulation, Vienna had no possible ground for taking action. In reality, then, this was a highly perfumed rejection on most points, and one can reasonably ask whether any other course was open to Pašić, now that, by refusing to take the initiative in shutting down the irredentist networks, he had allowed the crisis to reach this point. Various reasons have already been considered for the Prime Minister's peculiar passivity after the 28th of June, his continuing vulnerability after the recent struggles with the military party and the Black Hand Network, the deeply ingrained habits of reticence and secretiveness that he had acquired over 30 years at the dangerous summit of Serbian politics, and the fundamental ideological sympathy of Pašić and his colleagues for the irredentist cause. To these one could add a further consideration. Pašić must have had good reason to fear any thoroughgoing investigation of the crime, because this might well have unearthed linkages leading into the heart of the Serbian political elite. Any light shed on the machinations of Apis would have damaged Belgrade's cause, to put it mildly. But far more worrying was the possibility that the pursuit and investigation of the double agent Siganović, whom the Austrians had identified as a suspect, might have revealed the foreknowledge of Pašić and his fellow ministers, foreknowledge that Pašić had vehemently denied in his interview with Az Est the evening on the 7th of July. In a sense, perhaps, the Austrians really were demanding the impossible, namely that the official Serbia of the political map shut down the expansionist ethnic Serbia of irredentism. The problem was that the two were interdependent and inseparable. They were two sides of the same entity. In the Ministry of War in Belgrade, an official location if there ever was one, there hung, in front of the main reception hall, the image of a Serbian landscape, before which stood an armed allegorical female figure on whose shield were listed the provinces still to be liberated: Bosnia, Herzegovina, Vojvodina, Dalmatia, and so on. Even before he took delivery of the reply, Gisel knew that the acceptance would not be unconditional. An order for Serbian general mobilization had been in effect since 3 o'clock that afternoon. The city garrison had departed with great noise and haste to occupy the heights around the city. The National Bank and the State Archives were evacuating Belgrade, making for the interior of the country, and the diplomatic corps was already preparing to follow the government to its interim location at Kragujevac, en route to Niš. There was also a confidential warning from one of the ministers involved in drafting the reply. 5 minutes before the deadline, at 5:55 p.m. on Saturday the 25th of July, Pašić appeared at the Austrian legation and handed over the note, saying in broken German — he did not speak French — "Part of your demands we have accepted. For the rest, we place our hopes on your loyalty and chivalry as an Austrian general," and left. Gisel cast a supercilious eye over the text, saw it was wanting, and signed a pre-prepared letter informing the Prime Minister that he would be leaving Belgrade that evening with his staff. The protection of Austro-Hungarian citizens and property was formally entrusted to the German legation. The codes were taken from the strong room and burned, and the luggage, already packed, was carried out to the cars waiting at the door. By 6:30 p.m., Gisel, his wife, and the legation staff were on the train out of Belgrade. They crossed the Austrian border 10 minutes later. Did this mean war? In a curious telegram of the 24th of July to Mensdorf in London, Berchtold instructed the ambassador to inform Edward Grey that the Austrian note was not a formal ultimatum, but a time-limited démarche, whose expiry without a satisfactory result would bring about the cessation of diplomatic relations and the commencement of necessary military preparations. Yet war was still not inevitable. If Serbia subsequently decided to back down, under the pressure of our military preparations, Berchtold continued, she would be asked to pay an indemnity in respect of Austria's costs. On the following day, as Berchtold was travelling westwards to Bad Ischl to meet with Emperor Franz Joseph, a telegram from First Section Chief Count Marchio in Vienna reached him at Lambach. Marchio reported that the Russian chargé d'affaires in Vienna, Kudaschev, had made an official request for an extension of the deadline. In his reply, Berchtold stated that an extension was impossible, but he added that even after expiry of the deadline, Serbia could still avoid war by complying with Austria's demands. Perhaps these words reflected, as Albertini believed, a momentary failure of nerve. Perhaps, on the other hand, they were merely a play for time. We have seen how anxious the Austrians were not to get behindhand with their military preparations once these became necessary. In retrospect, It is clear that there was no mileage in these last-minute manoeuvres. On the 26th and 27th of July, exultant dispatches arrived from Spolykovich, bringing news that the Russians were mobilizing an army of 1,700,000 men and planned immediately to commence an energetic offensive against Austria-Hungary as soon as it attacks Serbia. The Tsar was convinced, Spolykovich reported on the 26th of July, that the Serbs would fight like lions and might even destroy the Austrians single-handedly from their redoubt in the interior of the country. The stance of Germany was as yet unclear, but even if the Germans did not enter the fray, the Tsar believed there was a good chance of bringing about a partition of Austria-Hungary. Failing that, the Russians would execute the French military plans so that victory against Germany is also certain. So excited was Spolykovich, the former political chief of the Serbian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, that he turned to proposing policy. "In my opinion, this presents to us a splendid opportunity to use this event wisely and achieve the full unification of the Serbs. It is desirable, therefore, that Austria-Hungary should attack us. In that case, onwards in the name of God." These effusions from St. Petersburg contributed to a further hardening of the mood. Last-minute concessions to Austrian demands were now inconceivable. Pašić had long believed that the union of the Serbs would not be achieved in peacetime, that it would be forged only in the heat of a great war and with the help of a great power. This was not, and had never been, a plan as such. It was an imagined future, whose hour now seemed imminent. Nearly 2 weeks would pass before any serious fighting took place, but the road to war was already in sight. For Serbia, there would be no looking back. A local war begins. On the morning of the 28th of July, 1914, Emperor Franz Josef signed his declaration of war on Serbia with an ostrich feather quill at the desk in his study in the Imperial Villa at Bad Ischl. In front of him was a bust in brilliant white marble of his dead wife. At his right elbow was a state-of-the-art electric cigar lighter, an unwieldy bronze structure on a plinth of dark wood, whose plated cord led to a wall socket behind the desk. The text followed the manifesto format the Austrians had used for declaring war on Prussia in 1866. "To my peoples, it was my fervent wish to consecrate the years which, by the grace of God, still remain to me, to the works of peace, and to protect my peoples from the heavy sacrifices and burdens of war. Providence, in its wisdom, has otherwise decreed. The intrigues of a malevolent opponent compel me, in the defence of the honour of my monarchy, for the protection of its dignity and its position as a power, for the security of its possessions, to grasp the sword after long years of peace." By this time, Belgrade was already a depopulated city. All men of serving age had been called up, and many families had left to take refuge with relatives in the interior of the country. Most of the foreign nationals had gone. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the 28th of July, the rumour of imminent war spread like a bushfire through the city. Extra editions of all newspapers sold as soon as the vendors could carry them onto the street. Before the day was out, 2 Serbian Danube steamers carrying ammunition and mines had been seized by Austrian pioneers and watchmen. Shortly after 1 o'clock on the following morning, Serbian troops blew up the bridge over the river Save between Semlin and Belgrade. Austrian gunboats opened fire, and after a brief engagement, the Serbian troops withdrew. The news that war had finally been declared filled Sigmund Freud, now 58 years of age, with elation. "For the first time in 30 years, I feel myself to be an Austrian, and feel like giving this not very hopeful empire another chance. All my libido is dedicated to Austria-Hungary." 11. Warning shots. Firmness prevails. After 4 hectic days of receptions, military reviews, speeches, dinners and toasts, Maurice Paleologue needed some rest. Having seen Poincaré off on the France on the evening of the 23rd of July, he told his servant to let him sleep in on the following morning. But it was not to be. At 7 o'clock came an urgent telephone call announcing the Austrian ultimatum. As the ambassador lay in bed, still half asleep, the news entered his mind like a waking dream. The occurrence seemed to me unreal and yet definite, imaginary but authentic. I seemed to be continuing my conversation of yesterday with the Tsar, putting my theories and conjectures. At the same time, I had a sensation, a potent, positive, and compelling sensation, that I was in the presence of a fait accompli. Paleolog cancelled his lunchtime date and agreed instead to a meeting at the French embassy with Foreign Minister Sazonov and the British ambassador Sir George Buchanan. According to his own memoirs, Paleolog reminded his two guests of the toasts exchanged between the President and the Tsar on the previous night, and repeated that the three Entente powers must adopt a policy of firmness. Sazonov was taken aback. But suppose that policy is bound to lead to war? Firmness would lead to war, Paleolog replied, only if the Germanic powers had already made up their minds to resort to force to secure their hegemony over the East. Here the French ambassador mirrored exactly the argument Bethmann had made to Riesler during the second week of July. Whether Sazonov was really as passive as Paleolog's account suggests may be doubted. In the dispatch George Buchanan filed on the same conversation, it was Sazonov who raised the stakes, declaring that Russia would at any rate have to mobilize. Whoever said what, the three men clearly took a drastic view of the situation created by Austria's presentation of the note to Belgrade. Sazonov and Paleolog joined forces in urging Buchanan to dissuade his government from a policy of neutrality that would be tantamount to suicide. Buchanan agreed and undertook to make strong representations to Grey in favour of a policy of resistance to German arrogance. Count de Robien, who spoke with the ambassador that afternoon, was aghast. At this noxious lunch, he recalled, they all goaded each other on. Paleolog was apparently particularly vehement, boasting of his conversations with Poincaré. In fact, Sazonov needed no persuading from Paleolog or anyone else. Even before his lunch at the French embassy, he had dressed down the Austrian ambassador in terms that left no doubt about how he read the situation and how he intended to respond to it. After Fritz Zapery, following the customary practice in such cases, had read aloud the text of the Austrian note, Sazonov barked several times over, "I know what it is! You want to make war on Serbia! The German newspapers have been egging you on! You are setting fire to Europe. It's a great responsibility you are taking on. You will see what effect this has in London and Paris, and maybe elsewhere too." Zapery proposed to send him a dossier of evidence supporting Vienna's claims, but Sazonov waved the offer aside, saying he was not interested. "You want war, and you've burned your bridges." When Zapery replied that Austria had a right to defend its vital interests and was the most peace-loving power in the world, Sazonov responded with a sarcastic retort. "One can see how peaceful you are, now that you are setting fire to Europe." Zapery left the meeting in an excited state, and rushed straight to the Austrian embassy to encode and dispatch his report. No sooner had the Austrian ambassador left than Sazonov summoned the chief of the Russian general staff, General Yanushkevich, to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The government, he declared, would soon be issuing an official press announcement to the effect that Russia did not intend to remain inactive if the dignity and integrity of the Serb people, brothers in blood, were under threat. A corresponding note was released to the press on the following day. Then he discussed with Yanushkevich plans for a partial mobilization against Austria-Hungary alone. During the days that followed the presentation of the note, the Russian foreign minister stuck to his policy of firmness, striking postures and making decisions that escalated the crisis. At 3 p.m. that afternoon, there was a 2-hour meeting of the Council of Ministers. Sazonov, fresh from his lunch with Paleolog and Buchanan, was the first to speak. He began by sketching out what he saw as the broader background to the current crisis. Germany, he declared, had long been engaged in systematic preparations, aimed not just at increasing its power in Central Europe, but at securing its objectives in all international questions, without taking into consideration the opinion and influence of the powers not included in the Triple Alliance. Over the last decade, Russia had met these challenges with unfailing moderation and forbearance, but these concessions had merely encouraged the Germans to use aggressive methods. The time had come to take a stand. The Austrian ultimatum had been drawn up with German connivance. Its acceptance by Belgrade would transform Serbia into a de facto protectorate of the Central Powers. Were Russia to abandon its historic mission to secure the independence of the Slav peoples, she would be considered a decadent state, would forfeit all her authority and her prestige in the Balkans, and would henceforth have to take second place among the powers. A firm stand, he warned, would bring the risk of war with Austria and Germany, a prospect all the more dangerous for the fact that it was as yet still uncertain what position Great Britain would take. The next to speak was the Minister of Agriculture, A.V. Krivoshein, one of the ministers who had opposed and intrigued against Vladimir Kakovtsev. He enjoyed the special favour of the Tsar, and was closely associated with the nationalist lobby in the Duma. As Minister of Agriculture, he was also closely affiliated with the Zemstvos, noble-dominated elected organs of local government that spanned most of the Russian Empire. He had been linked for years to the Novoe Vremya, known for its nationalist campaigns on Balkan questions and the Turkish Straits. He had supported Sukhamlinov's policy of partial mobilization against Austria in November 1912, on the grounds that it was high time Russia stopped cringing before the Germans. He also appears to have been on quite close terms with the garrulous Milica of Montenegro, who viewed him as an ally in Montenegro's struggle to redeem South Slavdom. After Kakovtsev's departure, Krivoshein was the most powerful man on the Council of Ministers. His views on foreign policy were hawkish and increasingly Germanophobic. In his words to the Council of Ministers on the 24th of July, Krivoshein invoked a complex array of arguments for and against a military response, but ultimately opted for a firm reaction to the Austrian démarche. Russia, he noted, was without question in an incomparably better political, financial, and military position than after the catastrophe of 1904 to 1905. But the rearmament program was not yet complete, and it was doubtful whether Russia's armed forces would ever be able to compete with those of Germany and Austria-Hungary in terms of modern technical efficiency. On the other hand, general conditions had improved in recent years. Perhaps he was referring to the strengthening of the Franco-Russian alliance, and it would be difficult for the imperial government to explain to the public and the Duma why it was reluctant to act boldly. Then came the nub of the argument. In the past, Russia's exaggeratedly prudent attitudes had failed to placate the Central European powers. To be sure, the risks to Russia in the event of hostilities were great. The Russo-Japanese War had made that clear. But while Russia desired peace, further conciliation was not the way to achieve it. War could break out in spite of our efforts at conciliation. The best policy under the present circumstances was, therefore, a firmer and more energetic attitude towards the unreasonable claims of the Central Powers. Krivoshein's statement made a profound impression on the meeting, and none of the speakers who followed said anything to modify his conclusions. War Minister Sukhomlinov and Naval Minister Grigorovich admitted that the rearmament program was still unfinished, but both stated nevertheless that hesitation was no longer appropriate, and saw no objection to a display of greater firmness. Peter Bark, speaking for the Finance Ministry, expressed some concerns about the capacity of Russia to sustain the financial and economic strains of a continental war, but even he acknowledged that further concessions were in themselves no guarantee of peace, and, since the honour, dignity, and authority of Russia were at stake, he saw no reason to dissent from the opinion of the majority. Summing up that opinion, Premier Garamykin concluded that it was the imperial government's duty to decide immediately in favour of Serbia. Firmness was more likely to secure peace than conciliation, and, failing that, Russia should be ready to make the sacrifices required of her. Finally, the meeting agreed the following five resolutions. 1. Austria would be requested to extend the time limit of the ultimatum. 2. Serbia would be advised not to offer battle on the frontier, but to withdraw its armed forces to the centre of the country. 3. The Tsar would be requested to approve, in principle, the mobilization of the military districts of Kiev, Odessa, Kazan, and Moscow. 4. The Minister of War would be instructed to accelerate the stockpiling of military equipment. And 5. Russian funds currently invested in Germany and Austria were to be withdrawn. It's war this time. On the next day, the 25th of July, there was a further, more solemn meeting of the Council of Ministers, presided over by the Tsar and attended both by Chief of Staff Yanushkevich and by Grand Duke Nikolai, commander of the St. Petersburg district and the husband of Anastasia of Montenegro, who had spoken so forthrightly with President Poincaré during the state visit. This meeting confirmed the Council's decisions of the previous day and agreed on further, more elaborate military measures. Most importantly of all, the Council decided to authorize a complex batch of regulations known as the Period Preparatory to War. These measures, which involved numerous dispositions intended to prepare for mobilization, were not to be confined to the districts bordering on Austria, but would apply right across European Russia. It would be difficult to overstate the historical importance of the meetings of the 24th and 25th of July. In one sense, they represented a kind of last-minute renaissance of the Council of Ministers, whose influence over foreign policy had been in decline since the death of Stolypin. It was rather unusual for foreign policy to be debated in this way by the Council. In focusing the minds of his colleagues on Germany as the alleged instigator of the current crisis, Sazonov revealed the extent to which he had internalized the logic of the Franco-Russian alliance, according to which Germany, not Austria, was the principal adversary. That this was an Austrian rather than a German crisis made no difference, since Austria was deemed to be the stalking horse for a malevolent German policy whose ultimate objectives, beyond the acquisition of hegemony in the Near East, remained unclear. As for the problem of Russia's relative unreadiness for war, by comparison with its prospective condition in 3 years, the ministers addressed this issue by referring in vague terms to a war which would come anyway, even if Russia chose to conciliate the Germans by not attacking their Austrian allies. This line of argument superficially resembled the train of thought that preoccupied Bethmann during the first weeks of July, that one could view the Sarajevo crisis as a means of testing Russia's intentions. If the Russians opted, despite everything, for a European war, that would mean they had wanted war anyway. But there was a crucial difference. In Bethmann's case, this argument was deployed to justify accepting a war, should Russia choose to start one. At no point, until after Russian general mobilization, was this argument used to justify preemptive military measures by Germany. In St. Petersburg, by contrast, the measures being considered were proactive in nature, did not arise from a direct threat to Russia, and were highly likely, if not certain, to further escalate the crisis. The practical military measures adopted at the two meetings are especially baffling. First, there was the fact that the partial mobilization agreed by Sazonov and Yanushkevich, and subsequently adopted in principle at the meeting of the 24th of July, was a grossly impractical and potentially dangerous procedure. Even a partial mobilization, if it posed a direct threat to Austria-Hungary, would inevitably, by the logic of the Austro-German alliance, call forth countermeasures by Berlin, just as a German partial mobilization against Russia would inevitably have triggered countermeasures by France, whether or not Germany chose to mobilize on its Western Front. And should these countermeasures occur, the frontier areas in which mobilization had not occurred would be doubly exposed, as would be the right flank of the Southern Army group that had mobilized against Austria. The room for maneuver created by the partial nature of the mobilization was thus largely illusory. Even more worrying was the fact that Russian plans simply did not provide for a partial mobilization. There existed no separate schedule for a mobilization against Austria alone. The current planning regime, known as Mobilization Schedule No. 19, was a seamless whole, an all-or-nothing proposition, that made no distinction between the two adversaries. Variations in population density across the different districts meant that most of the Army Corps drew on reservists from other mobilization zones. Moreover, some Army Corps in the areas adjoining Austria were earmarked, in the event of full mobilization, for deployment into parts of the Polish salient adjoining Germany. As if all this were not bad enough, a mobilization restricted to some sectors would wreak havoc on the immensely complex arrangements for rail transit into and across the concentration zones. Improvising an Austria-only mobilization would therefore not only be risky in its own right, it would jeopardize Russia's ability to make the transition to a full mobilization, should this subsequently become necessary. In view of these difficulties, it is astonishing that the partial mobilization policy was ever given serious consideration. Why did Sazonov press for it? One can understand the superficial appeal of a measure that seemed to offer something short of the full mobilization that must by necessity trigger a continental war. Sazonov doubtless remembered the winter crisis of 1912-13, when the army had improvised a stopgap mobilization plan against Austria-Hungary. And as a civilian in an environment where military expertise was jealously guarded and civil-military communications were poor, Sazonov, whose ignorance of military matters was notorious, may have known no better. He clearly received extremely poor advice from the chief of the general staff, Yanushkevich, a man of very modest abilities who was still somewhat out of his depth after only 5 months in office. Yanushkevich, a courtier rather than a soldier, had seen no service in the field, and his promotion, which was said to have excited general surprise, was probably due more to the Tsar's affection for him than to his professional qualifications. Yet even after Yanushkevich's subordinates, and Yanushkevich himself, had pointed up the absurdity of the partial mobilization plan, Sazonov refused to discard it. Perhaps he felt he needed to be able to offer the Tsar an alternative to full mobilization. Perhaps he hoped that partial mobilization would suffice to persuade the Austrians and the Germans to back down. Perhaps, on the other hand, he hoped with the offer of partial mobilization to coax the Tsar into a situation from which he would be forced to progress to the real thing. At the very least, these uncertainties suggest a certain disjointedness at the apex of the Russian executive, an impression reinforced by the fact that the Tsar was allowed to add the Baltic fleet to Sazonov's partial mobilization plan, although this made a nonsense of the foreign minister's intention to avoid antagonizing Germany. In any case, for the moment, the policy of partial mobilization remained a red herring, at least until the 28th of July, when the government chose actually to announce it. In the meanwhile, the Council of Ministers had resolved an even more important decision, namely the activation of the Regulation on the Period Preparatory to War of the 2nd of March, 1913. This pre-mobilization law provided for heightened security and readiness at magazines and supply depots, the accelerated completion of railway repairs, readiness checks in all departments, the deployment of covering troops to positions on threatened fronts, and the recall of reservists to training camps. And there were other measures. Troops in training at locations remote from their bases were to be recalled immediately. Around 3,000 officer cadets were to be promoted to officer rank to bring the officer corps up to wartime strength. Harbors were to be mined, horses and wagons assembled, and the state of war was to be declared in all fortresses in the Warsaw, Vilnius, and St. Petersburg districts, so that the military authorities would possess the fullness of powers required to ensure speedy general mobilization when the order came. And these measures were put in force not only in the Austrian border zones, but across the entirety of European Russia. Needless to say, these measures were fraught with risk. How would the Germans and the Austrians be able to tell the difference between Russia's far-reaching pre-mobilization measures and the opening phase of a mobilization proper? The text of the regulation of the 2nd of March conveys an impression of the scale of the measures underway. According to its stipulations, reserves were to be recalled to frontier divisions and instructed as to the uniforms and probable dispositions of the enemy. Horses are to be reshod. No more furloughs are to be granted, and officers and men on furlough or detailed elsewhere are to return at once to their troop divisions. Espionage suspects are to be arrested. Measures to prevent the export of horses, cattle, and grain are to be worked out. Money and valuable securities are to be removed from banks near the frontier to the interior. Naval vessels are to return to their harbors and receive provisions and full war equipment. Yanushkevich raised the likelihood of misunderstandings by expressly advising the commanders in each district not to feel bound by the letter of the regulation of the 2nd of March and to overstep the prescribed measures if they judged it appropriate. And, sure enough, many observers mistook the pre-mobilization for a partial mobilization. The Belgian military attaché in St. Petersburg reported on the 26th of July that the Tsar had ordered the mobilization of 10 army corps in military circumscriptions of Kiev and Odessa, adding that the news had been received with the greatest enthusiasm in military circles, and pointing out in a dispatch of the following day that the press had been informed that any public discussion of the mobilization of the army was strictly forbidden. German and Austrian consuls, diplomats, and attachés began firing off alarmed reports. From Copenhagen, the Austrian minister Count Széchenyi reported on the 26th of July that the Danish foreign minister, Erik Scavenius, had received news from St. Petersburg suggesting that Russia had already begun to mobilize, though in view of these precipitate offensive measures, Széchenyi thought it unlikely that France or England would feel obliged to intervene. On the following day, the Austrian consul, Hein, in Kiev, reported the recall of officers to garrisons and long lines of artillery units marching westwards out of the Kiev encampment, their destination unknown. Later on the same day, the 27th of July, he reported 16 trains loaded with artillery and Cossacks leaving Kiev and 26 military trains carrying artillery and sappers en route from Odessa, all bound for the Austrian border. The vast Kiev military camp was now empty. The troops had either moved to their winter quarters or were assembling at the station for embarkation. From Strzakowa, in the Polish salient, came a coded dispatch reporting that maneuvers taking place in the area had been broken off, and all troops concentrated in the city. A large contingent of artillery had been loaded into wagons at the city's Vienna station. During the previous night, 7 trains full of sappers had passed out of the station. From Moscow came reports that the Imperial Russian Air Force, second only to the French in size, had pushed westwards, while a cavalry regiment had arrived in the city from far-off Yekaterinoslav, today Dnipropetrovsk, nearly 600 miles to the south. From the Austrian authorities in Galicia, there were reports of decidedly large masses of troops, including artillery and Cossacks, moving into positions just across the border. From Butom on the east coast of the Black Sea came news of regiments of infantry, Cossacks, and dragoons on their way to Warsaw. Consular dispatches sent from across Russia to the German embassy in St. Petersburg reported the mining of rivers, the seizure of rolling stock, an entire Russian artillery division seen marching westwards out of Kiev, the interdiction of German encrypted telegraphy through the Moscow telegraph office, troops on their way back from maneuvers, infantry and cavalry units approaching Lublin and Kovel, the assembly of masses of horses at their points of concentration, large convoys of military vehicles on the move, and other signs of a mass army preparing to make war. As early as the evening of the 25th of July, when Maurice Paleolog went to the Warsaw station in St. Petersburg to say goodbye to Izvolsky, who was travelling back to Paris in hot haste, the two men were struck by the commotion around them. There was great bustle on the platforms. The trains were packed with officers and men. This looked like mobilization. We rapidly exchanged impressions and came to the same conclusion. It's war this time. Russian reasons. In taking these steps, Sazonov and his colleagues escalated the crisis and greatly increased the likelihood of a general European war. For one thing, Russian pre-mobilization altered the political chemistry in Serbia, making it unthinkable that the Belgrade government, which had originally given serious consideration to accepting the ultimatum, would back down in the face of Austrian pressure. It also heightened the domestic pressure on the Russian administration, for the sight of uniformed men and the news that Russia would not remain indifferent to the fate of Serbia stirred euphoria in the nationalist press. It sounded alarm bells in Austria-Hungary. Most importantly of all, these measures drastically raised the pressure on Germany, which had so far abstained from military preparations and was still counting on the localization of the Austro-Serbian conflict. Why did Sazonov do it? He was not a candid man and never produced a reliable account of his actions or motivations during these days. But the most plausible and obvious answer lies in his very first reaction to the news of the ultimatum. C'est la guerre européenne. Sazonov believed from the outset that an Austrian military action against Serbia must trigger a Russian counterattack. His response to the ultimatum was entirely consistent with his earlier commitments. Sazonov had never acknowledged that Austria-Hungary had a right to countermeasures in the face of Serbian irredentism. On the contrary, he had endorsed the politics of Balkan irredentism and had explicitly aligned himself with the view that Serbia was the rightful successor to the lands of unredeemed South Slavdom within the dual monarchy, an obsolete multi-ethnic structure whose days, in his view, were in any case numbered. It does not seem to have occurred to him that the days of the autocratic, multi-ethnic Russian Empire, whose minority relations were in worse condition than Austria-Hungary's, might also be numbered. Sazonov had denied from the start Austria's right to take action of any kind against Belgrade after the assassinations. He had repeatedly indicated in a range of contexts that he would respond militarily to any action against the client state. Already on the 18th of July, shortly after it became known that an Austrian note of some sort was in preparation, Sazonov had told Sir George Buchanan that anything resembling an Austrian ultimatum in Belgrade could not leave Russia indifferent, and she might be forced to take some precautionary military measures. Sazonov must have been aware of the immense risks involved, for he had joined Kokovtsov in opposing such a partial mobilization against Austria in November 1912, at the height of the Balkan crisis, on the grounds, as Kokovtsov put it, that whatever we choose to call the projected measures, a mobilization remained a mobilization, to be countered by our adversaries with actual war. The situation in 1914 was different, of course. The risks were greater, and, with Kokovtsov out of the way, the mood was less inhibited. But there was another important difference. Even in November 1912, Sazonov had added a rider to his support for a stand-down, saying that, even if we were ready for war, we had no right to undertake such steps without first coming to an understanding with our allies. About this understanding, at least with France, there could no longer be any doubt in the summer of 1914. It was not just that Poincaré and Paleolog had pressed so hard for Russian firmness on the Serbian question. It was that a crisis of this kind conformed exactly to the Balkan inception scenario that the alliance, over many discussions and summit meetings, had come to define in recent years as the optimal casus belli. In a fascinating dispatch filed on the 30th of July, the Russian military attaché in Paris, Count Ignatieff, who had numerous contacts among the most senior French military commanders, reported that he saw in all around him unconcealed joy at the prospect of having the chance to use, as the French see it, beneficial strategic circumstances. The Belgian minister in Paris registered the same upbeat mood. The French general staff is favourable to war, he wrote on the 30th of July. The general staff desires war, because in its view the moment is favourable and the time has come to make an end of it. It is simply not the case, as has sometimes been claimed, that Paleologue misrepresented French intentions and made undertakings to St. Petersburg for which he had no authorization from Paris. Nor is it true that he misinformed Paris about Russian mobilization in order to allow the crisis to mature to the point where Paris would be unable to restrain her ally. On the contrary, he alerted the French Foreign Ministry throughout to the measures adopted by the Russian government. A telegram composed at 6:30 on the evening of the 24th of July endorsed the principle of alliance solidarity in the interests of preserving peace by the use of force. A further telegram of 11 o'clock that night referred to the measures that Russia would without doubt be obliged to take if Serbia were to be threatened in her independence or her territorial integrity. And a further telegram composed at 4:45 p.m. on the following day and marked urgent and secret, reported that the Council of Ministers had that day agreed, in principle, the mobilization of the 13 army corps that are destined to operate against Austria. There followed the crucial sentence. The mobilization will be made public and effective only when the Austro-Hungarian government attempts to constrain Serbia by force of arms. However, secret preparations, préparatifs clandestins, will begin from today. Viviani would later explode with indignation at the news that things had been allowed to go so far so quickly, and would demand from Paleologue a full account of his doings during the crucial days of the crisis, accusing him of having withheld vital information on Russian measures. This is where the myth of Paleologue's unauthorized manipulations began. But although Viviani was out of the loop, as Poincaré no doubt intended him to be, Poincaré and Paris were not. In case the notes from Paleologue did not suffice, there were parallel dispatches streaming in from the French military attaché, General Laguiche, who reported on the 26th of July, for example, that secret military dispositions were already underway in Warsaw, Vilna, and St. Petersburg, all districts abutting the German frontier. Yet there was no call for restraint from the Quai d'Orsay. Nor did Poincaré, though he later falsified key details of his own involvement in the crisis, ever disavow Paleologue or the policy he had so enthusiastically represented in St. Petersburg. To be sure, there were moments when Sazonov's belief in a peaceful outcome seemed to revive. We have seen that the Austrians paused after receiving the ultimatum on the 25th of July in the hope that the actuality of Austrian military preparations might prompt last-minute concessions from Belgrade. Sazonov mistakenly read this as a sign that Vienna might be looking for a climb-down, and began to talk of a negotiated settlement. Until the very last moment, he told the French ambassador on the 26th of July, I will show myself ready to negotiate. What he meant by this became clear when he summoned Zapary for a frank and loyal explanation of his views. Working through the Austrian note point by point, Sazonov insisted on the unacceptable, absurd, and insulting character of every clause, and closed with an offer. Take back your ultimatum, modify its form, and I guarantee you we will have a result. This negotiation was hardly the basis for fruitful further discussions. In any case, the brief Austrian lull after the submission of the ultimatum was grounded not in Austrian doubts about the rectitude of their own course, but in the hope that Belgrade might back down at the last minute. The news of the Russian pre-mobilization naturally rendered these hopes groundless. No one was more excited by the spectacle of Cossacks boarding trains than Miroslav Spalajkovic, who saw in them the portents of a final struggle for Serbian unity and freedom. With the Tsar urging the Serbs to fight like lions, it was unlikely that Belgrade would entertain second thoughts about the terms of the ultimatum. And in the meantime, Sazonov had explicitly advised Belgrade not to accept a British offer of mediation. Even as they allowed the crisis to escalate, the Russians had to observe a certain caution. The French were committed to support Russia in a Balkan intervention, regardless of the precise circumstances in which that intervention was deemed to be necessary. But it was still important to placate French and British public opinion, and to keep the Germans quiescent for as long as possible. Since November 1912, it had been an established assumption of Russian mobilization practice that the concentration of troops and materiel should be completed, if possible, without beginning hostilities, in order not to deprive the enemy irrevocably of the hope that war can still be avoided. During this period of latent mobilization, clever diplomatic negotiations would be used to lull to sleep as much as possible the enemy's fears. When mobilization is ordered in Russia, Paleologue reported to Paris on the 25th of July after a conversation with Sazonov, it will take place against Austria only, and will avoid taking the offensive, in order to leave Germany with a pretext for not invoking straight away the casus foederis. It was also essential, for the sake of Russian, French, and British public opinion, that Austria, not Russia, be seen as the aggressor. "We must let Austria place herself entirely in the wrong," Sazonov told Paleologue on the 24th of July. This thought, that the opponent must be allowed to appear the aggressor, would crop up in all the key decision centres on both sides during the last days of the crisis. Was all this done on Serbia's behalf alone? Was Russia really willing to risk war in order to protect the integrity of its distant client? We have seen that Serbia's importance in Russian eyes grew during the last years before the war, partly because of the deepening alienation from Sofia, and partly because Serbia was a better instrument than Bulgaria for applying pressure to the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. Sympathy with the Serbian cause was strong in Russian pan-Slavist and nationalist circles. This was an issue with which the government could build useful bridges to its middle-class public. On the other hand, St. Petersburg had been willing to leave Belgrade to its own devices in October 1913, when the Austrians had issued an ultimatum demanding their withdrawal from northern Albania. And unlike Russia's neighbour Bulgaria, which possessed a piece of Black Sea coast, Serbia could hardly be seen as geopolitically crucial to Russian security. The robustness of the Russian response fully makes sense only if we read it against the background of the Russian leadership's deepening anxiety about the future of the Turkish Straits. The Russians, or more precisely, the Russian naval command, had been wishfully planning Bosphorus-seizing expeditions since the 1890s, and we have seen how the Bulgarian march on Constantinople, the disruption of grain exports during the Balkan Wars and the Lehman von Sanders crisis, pushed this issue to the head of the agenda in 1912 to 1914. By the summer of 1914, further factors were conspiring to heighten Russian apprehensions about the Turkish Straits. Most importantly, a regional arms and naval race had broken out between the Ottoman Empire and Greece, driven by a dispute over the future of the northern Aegean islands. In order to retain their edge over the Greeks, the Ottoman naval authorities had ordered two dreadnought-class battleships from the British firms Armstrong and Vickers, the first of which was due to arrive in late July 1914. This local power struggle was extremely alarming to the Russians. First, there was the danger, in the event of hostilities, of a further closure of the straits to Russian commercial shipping, with all the costs and economic disruption that entailed. Then there was the possibility that some lesser state, Greece or Bulgaria, might suddenly grab a piece of Ottoman territory that the Russians themselves had their eyes on. A further worry was that a Greco-Turkish war might bring the British Navy onto the scene, just when the Russians were pressing London to scale down the British naval mission. But most important by a long margin was the prospect of a Turkish dreadnought presence in the Black Sea, where the Russians possessed no battleships of this class. The arrival of the new Turkish dreadnoughts, the Russian naval minister warned in January 1914, would create a naval power with crushing, nearly sixfold superiority over the Russian Black Sea fleet. "It is clear what calamitous results the loss of our superior position on the Black Sea would have for us," Sazonov told the Russian ambassador in London in May 1914. and therefore we cannot stand idly by and watch the continued and also very rapid expansion of the Ottoman naval forces. At the end of July 1914, Sazonov was still entreating the British to retain the dreadnoughts destined for Constantinople. Exactly how much weight these concerns carried in Russian thinking during the July crisis is difficult to ascertain, since the official documents tended to focus on the Austro-Serbian epicenter of the crisis. There was a tendency to rationalize Russian decisions exclusively in terms of solidarity with the Slavic Little Brothers and the need to maintain Russian prestige on the Balkan Peninsula. Sazonov had learned his lesson and knew that an open bid for control of the Straits was unlikely to play well with his allies. The picture is complicated somewhat, however, by the fact that the Bosphorus was a specifically naval obsession, not shared by the Army General Staff. On the other hand, the Straits issue doubtless carried considerable weight for Krivoshein, whose responsibility for agricultural exports made him especially aware of the vulnerability of Russian commercial shipping. Recent instability in the Balkans had tended to fuse the Balkan theatre with the Straits question, so that the peninsula came increasingly to be seen as the crucial strategic hinterland to the Straits. Russian control of the Balkans would place St. Petersburg in a far better position to prevent unwanted intrusions on the Bosphorus. Designs on the Straits were thus an important reinforcing factor in the decision to stand firm over the threat to Serbia. Whatever the precise order of geopolitical priorities, the Russians were already on the road to war. At this point, the horizons of possibility began to narrow. It becomes in retrospect harder, though not impossible, to imagine alternatives to the war that actually did break out in the first days of August 1914. This is doubtless what General Dobrovolsky, head of the Russian Army's mobilization department, meant when he remarked in 1921 that after the St. Petersburg meetings of the 24th and 25th of July, the war was already a decided thing, and all the flood of telegrams between the governments of Russia and Germany were nothing but the staging for an historical drama. And yet, throughout the crucial days of the fourth week of July, the Russians and their French partners continued to speak of a policy of peace. The policy of firmness, as expounded by Poincaré, Sazonov, Paleolog, Izvolsky, Krivoshein, and their colleagues, was a policy that aimed, in the words of the Tsar, to safeguard peace by the demonstration of force. It is tempting to dismiss this language as a smokescreen of euphemisms intended to disguise the aggressiveness of Russian and French policy, and perhaps also to avoid putting off the policymakers in London. But we find the same formulations in internal correspondence and private utterances. There is an interesting contrast here with the analogous German documents, which speak more directly of war as an external threat, a necessity, and an instrument of policy. Yet a closer look at what Russian and French statesmen were actually doing when they spoke of the need to safeguard peace suggests that the difference was discursive rather than substantial. Why this difference should have existed is not immediately clear, but we should be wary of seeing in it the symptom of Germanic militarism or warlust. It may well reflect the deep impact of Clausewitz on German political language. The war of 1914-18 was the absolute negation of everything that Clausewitz had stood and argued for, but his subtle writings on conflict had depicted war as an eminently political tool, whose deployment, as a measure of last resort, should always serve political ends. By contrast, the language of the Russian and French decision-makers reflected the assumption that war and peace were stark existential alternatives. However, neither Clausewitz's sage injunctions on the primacy of politics nor heartfelt invocations of peace as the highest human good did anything to inhibit the decision-makers who took Europe into war in July 1914. 12. Last Days. A strange light falls upon the map of Europe. Throughout most of the July crisis of 1914, the eyes of the decision-makers in London were riveted on the nine counties of Ulster in the north of Ireland. On the 21st of May 1914, A bill introducing Irish Home Rule was passed by the Commons at the third reading, but rejected by the House of Lords. Dependent on Irish nationalist votes, Asquith's Liberal government resolved to use the provisions of the Parliament Act, which allows a government in such circumstances to circumvent the Lords and pass a bill by means of the royal assent. The prospect of a partial devolution of government functions to Catholic Ireland stirred deep and bitter controversy. The thorniest question concerned which counties, if any, of confessionally mixed Ulster should be exempted from Home Rule and thus allowed to remain in the Union. Despairing of a solution that would meet their demands, both sides, Catholic Irish nationalists and Protestant unionists, began preparing for an armed power struggle. In the spring, Ireland was on the brink of a fully-fledged civil war. This was the seedbed of the troubles that would continue to bedevil Northern Irish politics into the early 21st century. The tensions generated by the Ulster question reached deep into the political life of the United Kingdom, because they touched on the past, present, and future identity of the British polity. The Conservative Party, officially known as the Conservative and Unionist Party, was passionately opposed to Home Rule. Unionist feeling also ran high in the officer corps of the British Army, many of whose recruits hailed from Protestant Anglo-Irish families with a strong stake in the Union. Indeed, it appeared doubtful whether the Army would remain loyal if it were called upon to enforce Home Rule. In the Curragh incident of the 20th of March 1914, 57 British officers based at the Curragh camp in County Kildare proposed to resign their commissions rather than enforce the introduction of Home Rule against Unionist resistance. Among those within the Army leadership who supported Unionist insubordination was Director of Military Operations Henry Wilson, who had played such an important role in expanding the scope of the British contingency plans for a continental intervention. Wilson made less and less effort to mask his contempt for Squiff, as he called Asquith, and his filthy cabinet. He did not shrink from using the Home Rule question to blackmail the Prime Minister into meeting Unionist demands. In a memorandum presented to the Army Council to be put before the Cabinet on the 29th of June 1914, Wilson and his colleagues argued that the Army would need to deploy the entire British Expeditionary Force to Ireland if it were to impose Home Rule and restore order there. In other words, if the British government wished to impose Home Rule, it would have to renounce any military intervention in Europe for the foreseeable future. Conversely, a continental military intervention would mean foregoing the introduction of Home Rule. This meant in turn that officers of Unionist sympathies, which were extremely widespread in an officer corps dominated by Protestant Anglo-Irish families, were inclined to see in a British continental intervention one possible means of postponing or preventing altogether the introduction of Home Rule. Nowhere else in Europe, with the possible exception of Austria-Hungary, did domestic conditions exert such direct pressure on the political outlook of the most senior military commanders. Ulster was still consuming the attention of the British government when the news from Sarajevo broke. The Prime Minister did not keep a diary, but his intimate correspondence with his young friend and soulmate Venetia Stanley, an elegant and intelligent socialite, is diary-like in its candid and detailed accounts of Asquith's daily preoccupations. The letters suggest that the violent death of the Austrian royalties on the 28th of June scarcely impinged on the Prime Minister's political awareness, which was wholly focused on the queer things that are going on about Ulster. Asquith made no further mention of the international situation until the 24th of July, when he reported ruefully that yet another round of haggling over Ulster had collapsed, stymied by the complex confessional geography of Tyrone and Fermanagh. Only at the end of a long discussion of Northern Irish matters did the Prime Minister mention, almost as an afterthought, that Australia had just sent a bullying and humiliating ultimatum to Serbia, who cannot possibly accept it. We are within measurable or imaginable distance of a real Armageddon, which would dwarf the Ulster and Nationalist volunteers to their true proportion. Happily, there seems to be no reason why we should be anything more than spectators. This letter opened with the startling announcement that, The light has failed. But Asquith was referring to Venetia's departure from London that morning for her family's country home on Anglesey, not to the impending extinction of European civilization. For Edward Grey, these were days heavy with personal